Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
A content factory.
Yeah. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 202, a talk with Rocky Bucano. Rocky is the head of the Universal Hip-Hop Museum, a new and exciting project to share the history of hip-hop both in real life and in the virtual world. But Rocky's history goes way deeper than his current efforts. He learned to DJ in the Bronx of the 1970s, as hip-hop itself was coming of age. His cousin, the great Pete DJ Jones, gave Rocky his start, and Rocky ran with it. He moved from DJing to promoting parties to getting into the record business, discovering talents like Teddy Riley and Grand Puba. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. It helps us keep the lights on, and we've recently updated our rewards with some crazy new stuff. If you want to know about any of the media we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's the guy who brought you the guy who brought you Guy, Rocky Bucano. I am happy to be here on The Cipher with cool DJ Rock of the Come Off crew.
You did your research, huh?
We try. So I guess Rocky Bucano, when did you first get that DJ name?
I got that DJ name when I was about 14 years old. Mm-hmm. My cousin was Pete DJ Jones. Mm-hmm. So I followed, you know, in his footsteps, so to say. I started as a house DJ in the local neighborhood where I grew up at in the northeast section of the Bronx in the Valley. And I would just, you know, was DJing for my friends on my block, you know, birthday parties and stuff like that. And then it grew from doing the birthday parties on my block to other people in the neighborhood wanting me to DJ for their parties. And then lo and behold, came up with the name Cool DJ Rock. I think everybody was cool back in those days. You had Cool Herc, Cool DJ Rock. Cool DJ Red Alert. Everybody was cool. Mm-hmm.
Who was the Come Off crew? Were there other DJs? Were there MCs in the...
Well, the group started with just myself and one of my best friends. His name is Kelvin Jones. He went by the name of KBJ. So he was the MC and I was the DJ. And later on, other guys in the neighborhood saw what we were doing and they said, "Hey man, how do I get into the group?" So the next person that we added to the group was another MC by the name of Timmy Hall. And he went by the name of Timmy Hall, the baritone of the microphone. And then we added another DJ named Johnny G. He was the mix master. So it was myself, Johnny G, KBJ, and Timmy Hall.
Okay.
The Come Off crew.
Nice. And kind of what were your strengths as a DJ? What was your specialty?
I came out of the classic disco era. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always admired guys that can blend music and keep the crowd moving. You can even tell that the records change. So my forte was really mixing. It wasn't really cutting and scratching. I left that up to Johnny G. He was more of the guy that would come in with the, you know, the quick mixes.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about Pete for, you know, people who maybe are vaguely familiar with his name or who hadn't even really heard of him. Why was he important as a DJ?
Well, Pete was New York's number one DJ back then. He was a mobile DJ, and he would be synonymous with, you know, nightclubs in New York, especially, you know, black music, you know, where, you know, the African-American community would go out and party. They wouldn't go to the traditional nightclubs. They would go to places that promoters rented out. And Pete, being a mobile DJ, he would just go in, set up his sound system, and get the party, you know, rocking. You know, he had other DJs, he had MCs, Casey the Prince of Soul, and JJ the Disco King. So he became a staple of the New York City club scene. You would always hear his name on the radio. WBLS at that time was the only black radio station. So every time I heard his name, it was like, you know, it was always one of the big, big parties. And people look at Pete as being the precursor to hip hop because he, you know, didn't just play disco music. He would also just play the little loops like Kool Herc.
Oh,
you know, so okay. He would just play the breaks on certain records like Crown Heights Affair. Just kept that first drum part going on, you know, Crown Heights Affair records. So I just remember, you know, following him around. He drove this Volkswagen Jeep. It wasn't a Jeep, but it was like a truck, a minivan, so to say. And it had his name with music notes on it. So I always admired him. And just following in his footsteps was a blessing to me.
Okay. Did he personally teach you how to DJ one-on-one? Or did you pick stuff up by watching or a little bit of both?
A little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I really just picked it up by watching him. But he would, from time to time, be a guest DJ at the local club in my neighborhood, which was the Stardust Ballroom.
Mm-hmm.
So one night, I think I was 15 years old, and he had to go to the bathroom, and there was nobody else there. The other DJs wasn't, you know, Killer Herb wasn't around, and Starsky wasn't around. He said, "Rocky, you know, I got to go to the bathroom. You know, you want to, you know, spin some records while I go to use the restroom?" I was like, "Sure." I didn't know what the hell I was doing. You know, but I watched him, you know, set up the records, cue the records, how to backspin the records to set the records up, and started DJing. That was my first experience, you know, by him having to go to the bathroom. That was my first time playing in an actual nightclub.
Nice. And eventually you took over for him at the Stardust, right? That became your regular spot.
That became my regular spot. So what happened was that same night, the manager of the nightclub, his name is Kevin Bonfiglio, asked Pete, who was the guy that was playing for him, why he went to the bathroom. And Pete said, "Oh, that's my cousin, Rocky." So Kevin came up to me and said, "Man, you're pretty good." He said, "Do you, you know, would you like to be a DJ here at the club?" I'm like, "Well, that sounds good to me. I don't have a sound system like Pete does." Mm-hmm. He said, "You don't have to worry. We got our own house, you know, house sound system."
Right.
He said, "You know, I'll get back to you and let you know." And maybe like 2 weeks later, he said, "I got some promoters. They need a DJ. You want to come in and be the DJ?" And I had a small record collection at that time. So I spent the next couple of days just going to Rock and Soul and Downstairs Records, trying to get every record that I knew Pete had so that I had what he had, because right. I knew what he would play.
Right.
And that's how I started, you know, building up my record collection.
Wow. So kind of set that up for me. It's maybe mid-70s, 1975 or so, when this kind of really gets going for you, right? So at the Stardust, or at a sort of comparable place, who was your audience? How were people dancing? What kind of records would you play? What would a night there be like?
Yes. Yeah, so the crowd was much older than me, because I was 15, 16 years old at that time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even supposed to be in the nightclub, but fortunate for me, they looked the other way. So the crowd was in their late 20s, early 30s, more mature, dressed up, not the b-boy crowd for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, you know, kids break dancing or anything like that. So the dance style was freestyle and hustling. You know, the hustle was big back then. You know, so, you know, I played everything from Donna Summer to the Bee Gees to James Brown, Parliament Funkadelic. So, I mean, a very eclectic mix of music. But, you know, everybody enjoyed it, you know. So back then, it was a lot of disco, a lot of funk, a lot of soul. And that was basically all the music that I played.
And is there one record that, you know, would absolutely kill then, but that people don't really remember now, that comes to mind when you sort of think about those days?
Yes. Yeah, so the Glitter Band, Makes You Blind, was my record. It was an upbeat, high energy disco record, but enough funk in it that made people really excited when they heard that record.
I don't know that one. So, you know, you talked about growing up in the Bronx, and the Bronx is a big place. And especially then, the neighborhoods were very separate. How much were you aware of what was going on at the time in the South Bronx with Kool Herc's territory, or the West Bronx, or different areas of the city that sort of had their own things that would grow into hip hop in a few years' time?
So very interesting story. So where I grew up at, it's called the Valley. So, you know, we were very keen on Kool Herc. We would actually go to, you know, a lot of his parties. He DJed quite often in the Claremont section where I played basketball as a kid. Claremont is on Webster Avenue. It's the projects over there. So they have a big community center. We would go over there and, you know, hear Kool Herc, you know, play his records and watch the B-boys breakdancing. And we would breakdance. My friends and I would breakdance to Kool Herc's record, to his music. And I knew of Bambaataa because, you know, he was from the neighborhood. Before he started DJing in Bronx River, he would DJ in the community center in not too far from the neighborhood where I grew up at, on Darima Avenue. So a lot of people don't even know.
Right. They associate him so much with Bronx River.
They associate him with Bronx River. But before Bronx River, he was DJing where he grew up at, which was, you know, on Darima Avenue. And there was a little community center over there. And that's where he really started playing, you know, his music. And at that time, I was going to Truman High School. So I knew of Flash and Melly Mel and those guys. I knew of the L Brothers, you know. So they were on, you know, in the South Bronx, and DST was in the North Bronx with me.
DST is Grand Mixer DST, who later went by Grand Mixer DXT, and sat down with us for episode 68. He's perhaps best known for his turntable work on Herbie Hancock's 1983 track Rocket, which is the first mainstream popular track to feature scratching, including using the famous Fresh sample for scratching, which comes from B-side and Fab Five Freddy's Change the Beat. DST actually toured with Freddy along with Afrika Bambaataa, Ram LZ, and tons of others as part of a huge international tour in 1982. We also used the Fresh scratch throughout our archives. Fresh!
And Breakout was in the Northeast Bronx with me. So, I mean, we were all DJing pretty much at the same time. So it's quite unique when you hear hip hop started over here, started over there, but it's not quite that story. Mm-hmm. Really, hip hop was starting in many different parts of the Bronx, because although when they say hip hop, they associate hip hop with b-boying and breakdancing, which is true. That was part of it. But we were all spinning the same kind of records. There was no difference. I played Apache, Bongo Rock, and Dennis Corfee, Scorpio. Catch a Beat. Ralph McDonald, Jam on the Groove. We all played the same records. You know, there were some records that we tried to hide by putting the tape over or the white paper over, so that those were special records. I used to go to a place in Manhattan called Sunshine Records. And Sunshine Records was not an actual record store or record label. It was just a place that mastered plates. And you can actually get your mixes mastered onto a plate, and they had other DJs' plates, and you could buy those plates, and I would play those plates, and people were like, how the hell are you mixing all those records at the same time? And people didn't realize it was just a plate that was pre-mixed,
right?
And we would buy those things.
DJ tricks even then. Amazing. So when you were at Stardust, you used to open a lot for bands. What was maybe the best live band, or one of the best live bands you remember seeing during the period you were DJing there?
Well, my first time playing for a group was The Main Ingredient. Everybody plays the fool sometimes. And that was interesting. You know, I played for the main ingredients. I played for Blue Magic. Got played for Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. But I think the best band that came to the Stardust was Kool & the Gang. When they came, it was incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, Jungle Boogie, Hollywood Swing, all those songs that I was playing back in the house parties when I first started. Mm-hmm. Now I'm still live in the Stardust.
Someone who's come up on this show many times when we speak to people who grew up in New York City and listen to the radio is Frankie Crocker.
It's the Frankie Crocker Show.
Do it, Frankie. Do it to it.
Suck it to me, mama. Good evening, New York. This is the show that's bound to put more dips in your hips, more cut in your strut, and more glide in your stride. If you don't dig it, you know you've got a hole in your soul. And you don't eat chicken on Sunday.
Frankie Crocker was a veteran DJ best known for his time on New York City station WBLS. A few of the acts he's credited with breaking in the United States are Madonna, Bob Marley, The Clash, Shannon, and Sold Soul. He was the master of ceremonies at the Apollo, one of VH1's first VJs, and host of the TV show Solid Gold. On top of that, he once famously rode a white horse through the front door of Studio 54.
And that's someone you knew personally, right?
Yep.
What was your relationship with him?
Frankie was a good friend of mine. I became good friends of Frankie through my relationship with my cousin Pete, because Pete, again, was the DJ that, you know, you would always hear on the radio with WBLS. So Pete and Ken Spiderweb were very, very close.
Another name who's come
and,
up on the,
you know,
on the show.
One time when Pete was at the radio station, you know, just setting up commercials for a party, I got a chance to meet Frankie Crocker and just told him how much I admired him. And that I was a DJ and I wanted to be on the radio, which is pretty much the path that I wanted to take. I wanted to be on a radio just like Frankie Crocker. And as I got older and got more successful in the music business, I remained in contact with Frankie Crocker. And then when I had my record company, Strong City Records, is when I really, you know, became closer to Frankie. You know, he gave me advice on promotion and marketing, you know, how to get records, you know, played, although he did not want to play rap on WBLS, did not like rap until he gave, you know, Mr. Magic his show.
His show.
Then, you know, the rest was history on WBLS.
You know, like a boat, it's WBLS 107.5, the class of New York City radio. Good evening to your super listeners. How you doing tonight, all you fly guys and fly girls? Welcome once again to the world famous Mr. Magic Rap Attack. And of course, I am Sir Juice, your host for the next 3 hours, going to kick off 60 minutes of nonstop music.
Mr. Magic began his radio show, the first rap show to be aired on a major station, in 1981 on WHBI. In July of the following year, he moved the show to WBLS.
Yeah. You sort of moved from DJing into promoting parties as the 70s turned into the 80s. Why'd you get out of DJing and how did you see nightlife changing?
Well, I really never got out of DJing, so to say, but I wanted to be more than a DJ. Mm-hmm. For some reason, as a kid growing up, you know, I was always ambitious. I always wanted to be on the business side. And I saw that the promoters, you know, who rented the nightclubs and paid the DJ a couple hundred dollars, they would leave with a couple thousand dollars.
Yeah, right.
Right. So it was a big difference between what, you know, what we were making.
Right.
And so, you know, promoting parties became one of the things that I really enjoyed doing. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met one of my best friends to this day, Jerry Roebuck. He had Jerry Productions.
In 1989, Jerry Roebuck would go on to start Black Expo USA, an exposition showcasing minority enterprises. It grew to 16 cities and almost 500,000 attendees before shutting down in 1997.
So Jerry and I also lived in the same neighborhood. He lived in Carp City, not too far from where I lived at. And I promoted a lot of parties at the Stardust, but I also promoted parties downtown as well. And so did Jerry. So we became close because he would do really big parties at like Roseland and mm-hmm. Bonds International. And I would do parties at the Hotel Diplomat and the Copacabana and Cork and Bottle. So, you know, we had a little rivalry, but, you know, it was all good stuff. Mm-hmm. And what I enjoyed most about doing the parties was that I could program the parties. So, you know, back then it was like the battle of the DJs. Instead of hiring groups, we would hire all the top DJs. And mostly I focused on the special weekends like Easter weekend or Christmas Eve or New Year's, because that's when I knew everybody wanted to go out and have, you know, have a good time.
Right.
So, you know, I remember the first party, and Russell Simmons will talk about this. I had rented the Sesame Ballroom at the Hotel Diplomat, which was in the Times Square area. Mm-hmm. And I had Flash, I had Pete DJ Jones, I had New Sounds, I had a couple different DJs. And the line was around the block. And I remember, you know, Russell just, you know, saying that he was also doing a party, but his party wasn't as popular that same night. And he just remembers the line that was coming to my party was like wrapped around the block trying to get into to the Hotel Diplomat.
Wow.
So it was a very interesting time for me, because, you know, it was like seeing, you know, the power of marketing and promotion, mm-hmm. and how to, you know, put evenings, special evenings together that people would enjoy. You know, similar to being a DJ, you want to keep people happy. You want them to leave your party and say that they have had a good time.
Yeah.
So, you know, promoting parties was a really big thing for me.
And when did you mentioned Russell Simmons, when did you first cross paths with him? Was it in that sort of milieu of promoting parties and stuff?
Well, so I met Russell for the first time at City College.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I went to University of Buffalo and transferred to City College for a half a semester. And there was a lounge in City College where all the, you know, students would hang out. And I remember seeing Russell and Curtis Blow. We all were in the school at the same time. And I was DJing at that time, and Russell was doing club promoting. And he came to a couple of my parties where I was DJing. And I remember him, there was a night that I was DJing at FIT. They had like a little lounge next door to the school called the Lookout Lounge. Mm-hmm. And Russell brought Curtis by. And it's like, yo, can Curtis get on the mic? And I was like, get out of here. You know, so, you know, we know each other well, you know.
Yeah.
And years later, that Russell became the big, you know, the big impresario, and Curtis became the king of rap, and we're still good friends.
Right. And you work pretty closely with a guy who our audience might not know, but probably should, M. Morton Hall.
M. Morton Hall, another good friend of mine, another mentor of mine. M. Morton Hall in the 70s and early 80s was the big concert promoter in New York City for mm-hmm. African Americans. So, you know, he always did shows at what was called then the Felt Forum, which is at Madison Square Garden. He did Avery Fisher Hall, which is at Lincoln Center. He did shows at the Beacon Theater. He did a big concert at Shea Stadium. And he would bring acts like, you know, Sky and Brass Construction and Mandrill and Patti LaBelle and Stephanie Mills. He did it all.
Hall was also known for promoting shows with famous artists like Miles Davis, Chaka Khan, and Earth, Wind & Fire. In a July 1976 article in Black Enterprise magazine called The Promoters, they put him on the same tier as Frankie Crocker and Don King.
It was from M. Morton Hall that really opened my eyes to the concert and promotion business and introduced me to my other good friend, Milton LaCroix, because Milton was M. Morton Hall's sidekick.
Ah, okay.
At any concert and any club that M. Morton Hall was promoting, Milton was that guy that worked with M. Morton Hall to make sure that the promotion was right, make sure that, you know, the club was right. And Milton was a very flossy kind of guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, so he and I became very, very close. And Milton's still my guy to this day.
Yeah, Milton's quite a character. I've talked to him. You know, very, very interesting guy.
If you go look up Milton LaCroix nowadays, you'll find he's been training boxers for more than 30 years at his Supreme Team boxing gyms in New York and Florida. He even was Shannon Briggs' trainer both times Briggs won the World Heavyweight Championship. It was actually his experience in the music industry that led to his later career. After working with Rocky at MLO, a CBS record exec commissioned LaCroix to produce an album which Milton self-funded. When the exec refused to sign him, LaCroix was so angry that he, quote, wanted to smash him in his fucking head. He happened to walk past a boxing gym, went inside, and the rest is history.
How'd you go from being friends with Milton to saying, hey, we should form a record company?
So Milton, you know, just, you know, wanted to do a record label.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, knew a lot of different people. He knew, you know, all the big promoters. He knew all the, you know, the artists that were here, local artists that were here in New York. And he and I just said, you know, why don't we, you know, do a record and start a record company. So we started MLO Records, which mm-hmm. was music lovers around the world.
Right.
And our first artist on that label was Masters of the Ceremony and their record Crime. And we got Teddy Riley to produce that song for us.
Crime is the problem and the trouble is solving as the rate gets great and the world keeps evolving. Sweeping every state as they try to regulate these corruptive ideals which bring forth hate.
Teddy Riley is generally credited with inventing the melding of hip-hop and R&B known as New Jack Swing. He was a member of Guy and Blackstreet, but is even better known for his production work. He produced iconic songs for Keith Sweat, Bobby Brown, Johnny Gill, Big Daddy Kane, Rex in Effect, and of course, half of Michael Jackson's Dangerous album.
I was going to say that record has quite a history. I don't even know if he was a teenager, but young teen, probably 13, 12, 13, however old he was.
Yeah, I think he was about 13, 14 years old, but that was Teddy's first time in the studio. And that record came out amazing.
Yeah. So you discovered him at the Apollo? Is that how that happened?
So Milton discovered Teddy playing at the Apollo for amateur night at the Apollo. There was a guy by the name of Omar Chandler, which is Omar has passed away, but Omar was like Teddy's big brother and became, I believe, you know, he married his sister or something like that.
Omar Chandler was best known for his vocal performance on the 1988 hit Joy and Pain by Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. Chandler met Teddy Riley in the early 1980s and continued to work with Riley into the New Jack Swing days and beyond. Chandler was murdered in 2013.
But anyway, long story short, Omar had this big Teddy Pendergrass kind of voice, and Milton became his manager and was working very closely and mentoring Omar, really did everything for him, you know, paid his bills for him. And when he went to go see Omar perform at the Apollo, a little young Teddy Riley was playing the piano, and he was just like blown away, you know, by Teddy's skills. And from that point on, he was like, Rocky, you got to see this kid, Teddy. He is amazing. He plays the piano like you won't believe. And when I went to go see Teddy, I just was like, wow, this kid is simply amazing. And to find out that he didn't know how to read music or write music, he just played everything from ear was just blew me away.
Yeah. And so then you brought him into the studio and came out with Crime.
Absolutely. So we didn't know what we were doing in the studio, never been in a recording studio. And, you know,
so no one knew what they were doing.
No one knew what we were doing. We just like, Teddy, let's put together a drum beat. Let's put you on the piano and you just do what you want to do. And he went to work and the outcome was that record Crime.
Wow. And Master's Ceremony obviously had a pre-Brand Nubian Grand Poobah in it. What was your relationship like with Poobah? And I guess, did you know how talented he was?
Well, first and foremost, when I met the Masters of Ceremony, Doctor Who, Shabazz, and Grand Poobah Maxwell, I met them through Bill Brickell, who was their manager at the time. And that was a person that was friends with Milton.
Mm-hmm.
So Milton really introduced me to Bill, and Bill was the manager of the group. and Bill had like a little studio in his house, and he would do like pre-production work for the group. But when I saw Grand Poobah and heard, you know, his tone, his poetic delivery, and just his attitude, I was like, this guy's got talent, you know? So I immediately I was drawn to that group and wanted to work with them. One for all.
If my name was David Ruffin, quick to toast an MC just like an English muffin. Don't worry about a thing because the Poobah's never bluffing. I get headaches from the whack, so then I take a buffin and I max. I wait until the...
Really, we just wanted an excuse to play some Poobah and Brand Nubian because they're freaking great. You should go listen to some when you're done with the episode.
I guess I'm no beginner. This is how I spark it. Put money in my pocket. When it comes to having pressure, I get hard as a rocket. MC Grand Pool coming through all the residue. The songs are main classic, dating back to the Babaloo. My boys, I call them pop.
And so they released one single with you, but their album was actually on 4th and Broadway. Why didn't you end up putting out their full album?
Well, interesting. You know, so Jazzy and I put out their first record on the Strong City label, which was called Cracked Out.
Well, look, don't you ever try it.
Cause it'll rip you right apart. Cause all I hear is grief, and crack is all they do. I hate to be the one who say to someone that I knew.
Well, I got a homie, he does it all night. I tell him, get your big lips off of that mic.
And the Cracked Out record became very, very popular. But we were still a new label. We didn't have the funding necessary to take them to the next level. And at that time, we were in between two deals because we released Cracked Out. And then shortly thereafter, we released Busy Bee's record, Suicide.
You mess with me, you just committed suicide. Gal around now, I'm about to kick flip. All right, here I go. Guess what? When I was a young boy up in the South Bronx, I never carried a gun. I was knocking out chumps, punks. All
Suicide had caught the attention of MCA's Uni Records, and Kathy Jacobson became a fan of Masters of Ceremony. So she had offered, like, you know, what do you guys want to do? You want to take your label to the next level? I can give you an imprint deal. We can have Strong City 4th and Broadway. You know, we can put out the Masters of Ceremonies album on 4th and Broadway. And I just like Kathy Jacobson. I thought that, you know, she really wanted to do something special for the group. So instead of us, you know, putting out their album on Strong City, I just thought it would be in the best interest of trying to give the group a more exposure through Island, 4th and Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Poobah has said that, to his mind, you wanted Masters of Ceremony to do songs you viewed as more commercial, things more like sexy.
Couldn't care if you was ever coming back. Grand Poobah Maxwell will be right in his act. Ain't sexy, baby doll, you're so sexy.
And he felt like he wanted the group to do things more like Cracked Out, maybe more kind of socially conscious songs. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, you know, to a certain extent. You know, my thing was, at that time, it was so hard to get records on the radio that if you did the harder stuff, which was probably more true to his roots and what he wanted to do, it would have a difficult time getting on radio. So Sexy and doing the more commercial sounding records that I saw as being the first wave of records to get programmed on radio was kind of like the direction. If you want to sell records, you had to be on the radio. If you wanted to be, you know, just a, you know, a hardcore, you know, hip hop label that didn't sell any records, then you wouldn't produce records for radio. You would just concentrate on putting out the hard stuff and letting the streets dictate, you know, if they liked it or if they would be able to even find it.
Right.
You know, so, you know, my goal was really, as one of the label owners, was how do we get the maximum exposure possible for our artists?
So talk about the transition a little bit between you had Emlo and then you split with Milton and then you teamed up with Jazzy J to form Strong City Records. How did that all kind of go down?
So there was no formal contract with Emlo and the group Masters of Ceremony. Basically, we just basically did a handshake and said, you know, let's do this.
Yeah.
And with Jazzy kind of was a little bit disheartened by the love that he did not get from Rick Rubin and from Russell, because, as you know, he put out the first early Def Jam records.
Two of their first three singles, I think, were his. Yeah.
Jazzy J met Rick Rubin around 1984, helped him lay the foundation for Def Jam Records, and, according to some reports, actually introduced Rubin to Russell Simmons. Two of Def Jam's first three singles were by Jazzy J, It's Yours with Tila Rock and This Def Jam. For more about Jazzy J, you can also check out episode 198 with Skef Ansel.
He thought that there was going to be a partnership between him, Russell, and Rick, which never really materialized. So he was a little bit unhappy with that. And, you know, I saw Jazzy as a genius when it came to true, authentic hip-hop sounds, programming and engineering, and, you know, just being able to make great beats. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Jazzy, you don't need Def Jam. You can really have your own. So let's team up and let's do our own label and let's call it Strong City. And he was on board. He had the studio, obviously. And I, you know, had access to the first group, Masters of Ceremony. So we kind of like just merged together. And the rest was kind of like history after that.
Talk to me a little bit about discovering talent, because, you know, we talked about this with Skef. You guys had so much young talent at the very beginnings of their career, including Skef Anselm on the you know, engineering side. You had, obviously, Grand Poobah with Masters of Ceremony. You had Diamond D, as before he was even rapping, when he was just a DJ with Ultimate Force.
This is dedicated to my DJ, Diamond D. Imagine a man that can take a new beat and make a brand new fashion. Give a record a thrash and while he's scratching. And when he's done, he won't believe a ration.
The man who's got... Talk to me about discovering and nurturing young, almost raw talent in that phase in Strong City.
Yeah, starting with Teddy Riley, you know, giving him his first break. And then, you know, Grand Poobah giving him, you know, a platform to showcase his talent. And Busy B and Diamond D and Ice Cream T, a female rapper from Philly, who, in my opinion, was one of the best unheard female MCs at that time. She was incredibly a gifted writer and performer. But Strong City, in my opinion, was really like an incubator for hip hop talent. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you know, we had Skef Anselm that became a not only just a good engineer, but an awesome producer. Diamond D, who went from DJing to working with the Fugees as a producer.
Diamond D. I creep like a thief, no doubt the man swift. I'm more magnificent than Lee Van Cleef. You stand stiff and got the nerve to let your man rip.
We know where to run.
And start flaking like dandruff. Come on, son, my steelo's tight. Because by far, I'm the best producer on the mic.
Right.
On the right.
Then producing all these other artists afterwards and became a really good artist in his own right.
Yeah.
And, you know, so really it was, you know, between myself and Jazzy. Jazzy did a lot of the draw because everybody wanted to work with
him, of course. Yeah.
Right. And I was more of the business guy in the background. But, you know, I think I have a unique eye for spotting talent and seeing how talent is going to develop.
Mm. One sort of odd thing that I found interesting about Strong City is on one of the compilations you put out, you had a solo track from Tony D, who a lot of people know from producing Poor Righteous Teachers.
Back to the lab where I'm a blind, you a science. Turn you off like an appliance. This ain't a diss, it's just a lab experiment. I'm here for a second, now you don't know where I went.
How did that come about? Because I think that was even before Poor Righteous Teachers, right? That you had that track
with
him.
Yeah. So back to the lab. So I got introduced, Jazzy and I got introduced to Tony D from Trenton through Lady B, who, as everyone knows, is a famous radio air personality in Philadelphia.
Philly, yeah.
And Lady B was managing Ice Cream T. And she's like, you guys, you know, I got this white rapper. He's Italian. His name is Tony D. He spits rhymes like you won't believe. He's also an awesome producer. he would love to be part of the Strong City family. So she made the introduction. We met Tony. Tony's a great, energetic guy, you know. And when Jazzy and I heard what he had, we was like, "Yo, dude, we got to have you on the label." So he had a couple records, but we picked Back to the Lab. Back to the Lab just sounded a little bit like a white version of Rakim to me.
Mm-hmm.
It had that little kind of like flavor, and I was like, this guy's going to be something. He's really going to turn into something special.
Yeah.
So he and I, you know, decided to work together. I helped him secure his first solo album with Island Records.
Oh, wow.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. Someone you worked with in Strong City in the capacity of helping around out in the studio, answering the phones, was Ron Savage.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, you know, before we get into more recent stuff about him, tell me a little bit about Ron Savage or Bee Stinger.
Yeah, so Ron Savage, a.k.a. Bee Stinger, was a guy that just liked to be around the studio, a good friend of Jazzy's, and, you know, obviously a fan of hip hop. And, you know, he came, you know, with the Jazzy J package, you know, more Jazzy's friend than he was mine. But I really admired Bee Stinger because of his work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was just so into learning, you know, all about music and all about promotions and marketing. And he would just come in the office and I would give him a list of college radio stations to call and things to do. And he would just do it and he enjoyed doing it. You know, so he was like our little in-house promotion person.
Oh. What was your reaction when he talked about being molested by Bam?
In 2016, Savage claimed that he had been molested by Afrika Bambaataa back in 1980 when Savage was 15. Savage first spoke about the Bambaataa allegations, though he did not mention the hip-hop pioneer by name, in his 2016 memoir, Impulse, Urges, and Fantasies, Life is a Bag of Mixed Emotions. After three other victims came forward and lots of other turmoil within the Bambaataa-led Universal Zulu Nation itself, the organization extended its, quote, deepest and most sincere apologies to Savage and the other victims.
Yeah, it caught me by surprise, totally out of the blue, because I had no idea that that was even going on. And, you know, Bambaataa is a good friend of mine, and I never knew anything about anything, never even heard any allegations like that. So I was saddened to hear that, and at the same time, quite surprised and really not knowing, you know, who to believe, because, you know, an allegation is an allegation. But, you know, his story, you know, resonated and with a lot of people. And I just, you know, said, you know, this is something that, you know, really, really needs to be spoken about, because, you know, a person, if that was true, lived with that secret for so many years. And I guess, you know, when you get to his age, you know, there's comes to a certain point where you just can't live with it anymore. So, you know, I wasn't sure about the way he went about it publicly, because, you know, he was at the same time trying to promote a book. So I didn't know what the, you know, real motivation was behind it. But at the same time, I felt for him, you know, I felt his pain.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same, you know, I also felt, you know, that, you know, my friend Afrika Bambaataa, you know, that this would damage, you know, his persona. And it did. It really had a negative effect on, you know, Bam and everything that Bam stands for. You know, so, you know, there was no win-win situation in that,
right,
in that story.
Right. You know, one of the things that is unique about your career is you were working and very involved in the record business right at the time when hip hop was breaking through to the mainstream, right? Late 80s through early 90s-ish. You were very involved in the record business. You were making records, you were promoting records, you were doing deals with labels and stuff like that. What was that particular experience like for you when you saw this thing that you remembered you were DJing in, you know, 1975, before the thing even had a name, and, you know, you remembered your cousin spinning breakbeats around the same time as Ark, if not before?
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you to see this thing become an art form and then start to break into the mainstream in a big way by the early 1990s?
It was overwhelming, you know, because we were all learning on the job, so to say, you know, how hip hop was becoming this commercial product that the major labels were now focusing a lot of their resources on. So it was all exploding at the same, you know, at the same time. You had myself, you had Andre Harrell at Uptown, you had Russell and Rick and Leo, you know, with Def Jam, you had Profile Records, you had Tom Silverman with Tommy Boy, you had Tyrone Williams with Cold Chillin', you had Will Sokolov with Sleeping Bag. And all these guys were all my friends. We were all peers. We were all in the studio. We would see each other walking in and out of the studio. You know, hey, check out my new record that's getting ready to come. Oh, that's a smash. You know, so it was just really, really exciting. And to see that we were putting our fingerprints on the commercialization of hip hop, mm-hmm. what became today, you know, a global phenomenon. I look back on it now and like, wow, you know, we were really the trendsetters. We were really the guys that were opening the doors to make this culture really become the most popular art form on the entire planet.
Yeah.
You know, so it was an exciting time for me. It taught me a lot about myself, about perseverance, about stick-to-itiveness, creative artist development. You know, I learned the whole nine yards,
right?
You know, being in the music business, you know, from the publishing end to the you know, marketing end, you know, to the distribution side. So it was a worthwhile experience for me.
Yeah. And kind of a full circle moment in 1993, you reconnected with Teddy Riley and this time started working for him at one of his ventures. What was that like to reconnect with him again, but in a very different situation where now he's this superstar producer?
Yeah, so it was interesting because I gave Teddy Riley his first break to produce a record. I gave him his first opportunity to perform in front of a live audience when he was in the group Kids at Work. This was before Guy.
Kids at Work was Riley's group with singer Clairol Henderson and bassist Tommy Gatling. They released their debut album in 1984 and broke up several years later.
I did a showcase for him at the Copacabana, and then I had my label, and then he got his recording deal with Guy and Uptown, and we were, you know, Strong City was being distributed by MCA, and Guy was on MCA, so I would see Teddy in Los Angeles and New York, and just watched him become, you know, this superstar, you know, right before my eyes.
Yeah.
And so after, you know, Jazzy and I separated from Strong City, I did some marketing and promotion. I got hired by L.A. Reid and Dallas Austin to run Rowdy Records. And after leaving Rowdy was when the opportunity came to work with Teddy Riley. And he called me up, say, hey, man, you know, why don't you come work for me? You know, I need somebody, you know, so going back to work for him at New Jack Swing as the executive vice president of New Jack Swing Productions at that time was like almost like a dream come true because I had so many other opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I was being recruited by all the record labels and I chose not to do that. I chose to go back and try to help Teddy really organize his company and take him to the next level. He was already a superstar. He had produced the Dangerous album. He had produced Patti LaBelle and Bobby Brown and obviously Guy and Keith Sweat. So he was a superstar, but he really needed someone that he could trust, a friend, that a person that he knew would have his best interest. So that was a welcome experience for me.
So the thing that you are involved now and the thing you are repping on your sweatshirt is the Universal Hip Hop Museum. How did that start? I guess give me the sort of germ of the idea that became the Universal Hip Hop Museum, because there have been other efforts to get some kind of museum for hip hop specifically. And obviously the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has an ever increasing hip hop component.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So how did UHHM come about?
I was running a youth basketball program in the South Bronx called the Gauchos. And the Gauchos is probably one of the most successful AAU after-school boys and girls basketball program in the entire country. I was trying to expand the Gaucho brand because the organization has a fabulous gym in the Mott Haven section of the Bronx, but we can only accommodate X amount of kids in the program because the gym can only hold X amount of kids at one time. So I was approached by real estate developers about an opportunity to respond to an RFP that the city had issued for the Kingsbridge Armory up in the northwest section of the Bronx. The opportunity was to make the Gauchos a larger space at the Kingsbridge Armory. Long story short, we couldn't raise the funds. But the city of New York and the city council people that heard about the Gaucho wanting to expand up into the Kingsbridge Armory was extremely interested. So I had got a call from the chief of staff for Councilman Fernando Cabrera. His name is Greg Faulkner. And he said, Rocky, I know that you guys are not going to make it to the finals in the selection process for the Kingsbridge Armory, but there's another real estate developer who I want to team you up with. And his name is Young Wu. And I got to know him and he got to know a little bit about me. He basically just asked me, is there anything on the music side that would add value to his plan for the Kingsbridge Armory? I said, you know, it would be great if we could dedicate some space to a museum for hip hop. And he was like, that's interesting. What do you know about music? And he didn't know that I knew anything about music.
You said, well, let me start at the beginning.
Right. So yeah. Once I told him my music background, he was like knocked out. He's like, really? I didn't know. I thought you just was a basketball guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him that I knew the people that I can galvanize from the hip hop community and bring them together. And if you would make this part of your project and, you know, guarantee that you would do whatever in your power to make this museum happen, I'm sure that we can galvanize the entire hip hop community around your project to help you, you know, win the bid. So I bought Melly Mel and Bambada and Grand Wizard Theodore and Joe Conzo and Mickey Benson, Cutman LG and myself. And we all went down to Young Wu's office and he showed us his vision and his plan. And when he met everybody, he's like, wow, this is a great idea. So we became his advocates for his project.
And that was the beginning of the advisory board, which would grow to probably a couple dozen people by this point, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And We went to war for him, you know, because the city of New York wanted to put an ice skating rink and he was the opposition to the ice skating rink. So we were on his side and all the elected officials, including Mayor Bloomberg, were on the other side. And we got beat because the city just was what we want, an ice skating rink.
Mm-hmm. And that had a former hockey player,
Mark Messier and Sarah Hughes. So mm-hmm. They had two big stars and the city wasn't going to, you know, let them down. We had to regroup. We didn't even have the name Universal Hip Hop Museum at that time. It was after we had regrouped that I came up with the name Universal Hip Hop Museum
mm-hmm.
and started to work on the project independently. Melly Mel and everybody, you know, kind of like went on their own little paths, but we're still connected to the museum, to getting a museum off the ground. We just didn't know how or when or where. And because it was such a great idea, I said to myself that for some reason, this is like my calling, that I'm probably the one guy in the music business, in hip hop, that can really pull this project off.
Where are things now?
So since that first meeting with Young Wu, it's now 4 years later. So the Universal Hip Hop Museum, we've done a lot of different programming in the 4 years. We've done concerts at NJPAC, free outdoor concerts. Last year, we had Rakim. The year before that, we had Slick Rick. And this year, we have Curtis Blow. So we do an annual free outdoor concert for the people in Newark. We're developing an educational curriculum. We have a partnership that's just emerging now with the Department of Education here in New York City. So we're going to be doing a test model of a hip-hop-based curriculum for middle schools in the Bronx. And we're working on a digital platform, which will be the first iteration of the museum, giving the world online access to archives and photo collections and the history of hip-hop. But before we even get to the actual development of the virtual museum, we spent the last couple months doing envisioning sessions around the country. We inclusive design envisioning sessions that was underwritten by Microsoft. We held them in Los Angeles, Detroit, Atlanta, and New York. We did those because when it comes to developing any digital platform, you really have to get everybody's input in terms of like what the expectations are in terms of the user experience and how people will interact with the online exhibits and just a virtual experience. What is a virtual museum? How do you get immersed into the content? How do you access the content? We got input from all different kinds of people, people from the hip hop community on the West Coast, in Detroit, in Atlanta, in New York. People who are not even fans of hip hop were invited to come out, college students, high school students. So we got a broad spectrum of people that gave us a lot of input on user experiences. We want to create and are going to create something that represents the authenticity of the culture, but something that is quite unique that has never been done before online, because there's so many, you know, great ways that people interact. We want it to be something that kids would like to use, teachers would like to have as part of their learning experience inside the classroom, as well as people like you and people older who want to reconnect to the history of hip hop. We want to create like a digital community where people come to really get the full flavor of hip hop on a global level.
And the basis of your collection of physical objects, as I understand it, comes from a friend of the show, Paradise Gray,
right?
Who has an amazing archive of stuff.
Yes. So Paradise is our chief curator. Paradise has an amazing collection, but really we're open to everybody. So Ernie Panicelli, another great photographer, has an amazing collection of photographs that he's shot over the years. Joe Conzo is one of our advisory board members, has a great collection of photos. But not just people who have photos, you know, artists like Eric Orr and Fab Five Freddy and other, you know, well-known artists around the world, giving them a platform to showcase their artwork, you know, fine art, graffiti art, video content, you know. So we're trying to create a museum that is quite different than the normal traditional museum. We look at the Universal Hip Hop Museum as almost a content factory where we create unique experiences using virtual reality. We partner with Framestore, which is a virtual reality production studio here in New York, to produce our first VR demo, which we call the Curtis Blow Experience.
You can check out the Curtis Blow VR Experience app right now if you have an Android phone and Google Cardboard. We'll have a link in the show notes.
You know, we want to just basically, you know, use all of the digital technology that's known today and mash them up and really create unique experience online and offline, where we can do pop-up exhibits. And eventually when we have a brick and mortar space, you know, have it really set up in a unique way where that brick and mortar building is more of almost like a Universal Studio attraction, more so than a museum. So when kids and their families come in there, they're just taking on a journey through the evolution of hip hop history.
So what are your plans for it going forward? Are there moves being made toward a physical space? When can we expect to see more of an online presence? What do you have any kind of timeline for stuff?
We're in discussions with two different developers. One developer is we've partnered with to respond to another city RFP for the Lower Grand Concourse area, which is five blocks south of Yankee Stadium. It's a waterfront location, which is fabulous. We're waiting for the city to really get back to us with some additional information on process. We understand that we are highly favored. We have the support of all the Bronx elected officials. I just met with Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr., and brought Tom Silverman, who's on my advisory board, He's totally on board. We're working with this other developer who owns a piece of property and wants to have the museum built on his property. So we're just trying to work out the viability of maybe working with him to establish the museum on his particular property. Within the next 6 to 8 months, we're going to have an answer on an actual location for the brick and mortar, which is going to be a blessing. You know, we've been approached by other cities and other municipalities, but I think that would be, you know, egregious. And
got out of here.
People would throw knives at me if I allowed that to happen. So, you know, we're definitely going to keep the museum in the Bronx to pay homage to the origins of hip hop. Mm-hmm. This is all about raising capital now because we're talking about a massive project.
Of course.
So we're in our initial stages of creating a capital campaign, and we're going to have our first big major fundraiser at the Apollo Theater this year, our coming out party, December 5th. So we're talking to the Apollo about, you know, the programming components that we want to have produced on that night. And it's all about fundraising. It's all about bringing the big names now, bringing the Dr. Dre's and the Diddy's and the Russell Simmons and getting everybody all on board. Because like you said early on, there have been other attempts to get a museum established. This one is the one that has the legs and the energy and the momentum to really happen. Mm-hmm. But now we need to get all of the, you know, the big players in hip hop behind the project to help push it forward.
Right. And with fundraising, can you see having a crowdfunding component? I know you had one earlier that didn't go quite as well as you expected.
Yeah. We're partnering with an organization called Spot Fund. Unlike Kickstarter and some of the other crowdfunding platforms, Spot Fund is a micro funding platform. Donations as small as a dollar and as large as three. That's it. You can donate, you know, much more if you want to, but we're asking people to donate as little as a dollar or as much as $3, trying to take on the political campaign fundraising strategy of Barack Obama, mm-hmm. where you get millions of people to donate just a dollar and you can reach your goal a lot faster. Hip hop has a global fan base that is in the millions of people that really grew up with hip hop. To make this project happen, you know, we believe that people like you and other people who are passionate about hip hop culture will have no problem coming out of your pocket for a dollar to support the development of the Universal Hip Hop Museum.
Excellent. Well, we will definitely, once Spot Fund is up and running, we will definitely let our listeners know. Rocky Buchano, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you, Sean.
It was somewhat of a coincidence, but I'm glad that our episodes with Rocky and his old business partner Skeff Anselm aired within a few weeks of each other. Their work with Jazzy J at Strong City Records is, to my mind, underappreciated, and I don't think there's any other place you can find so much of the label story. But really, Strong City is just a part of what makes Rocky's journey so fascinating. It was great to take it all the way back to his early days DJing, and I hope you got a clear idea of why he's the perfect person to head up efforts to finally put hip-hop's history in a museum. For more information on the Universal Hip-Hop Museum, visit uhhm.org. We wanted to point out that Rocky had a different take on the Afrika Bambaataa situation than other people we've spoken to about it, and we think it's worthwhile for people to get a bunch of opinions on the topic. You can find more varied takes on the controversy in our episodes with Skeff Anselm, TC Islam, Fat Joe and Remy Ma, and Paradise Gray. Join us next week when our guest will be Alan Grunblatt. Alan is the head of E1 Records, formerly known as Koch. He has a decades-long history in the record business and has played a key role in the career of artists as varied as Cameron, Bone Thugs and Harmony, and Fat Joe. We'll also discuss how he was able to work with both Ruthless Records and Death Row. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with Rocky's old pal Skeff Anselm on episode 198. Whatever you use to listen to this show, iTunes, Apple's podcast, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, we could at least afford to eat while researching and editing. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share audio that we get from our guests. either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Become a patron by the end of May to get access to June's file. This month, we have the great producer and engineer Skef Anselm talking about the positive effects of sampling for unknown artists, what it was like to meet the producers he influenced, and the interconnectedness of the New York music scene. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
That's interesting. What do you know about music?
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
A white version of Rakim to me.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
By him having to go to the bathroom. That was my first time playing in an actual nightclub.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
No one knew what we were doing.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Steve Berger.
A genius when it came to true, authentic hip-hop sounds.
And a special shout-out to Adam Silverstein for helping to make this episode happen.
The big impresario.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Hi, Dougie.